Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. I am now covering in this audio Exodus chapter 5, verses 1 through 23, the entire chapter. We're going to look at the Hebrew slaves trying to make bricks without straw. Our context is this. In the last chapter, Moses presented his three signs to the Hebrew people. The Hebrew slave said, "Yes, Moses, you're our leader." And Moses, with his mouthpiece Aaron, then is now prepared to go to the Pharaoh to let the people go worship in the wilderness, ostensibly, but of course, probably it was to leave Egypt and go to Canaan. So that's our context as we start chapter 5, verses 1 and 2. And afterward, that's after Moses had delivered the three signs to the people, and they believed in him as a leader. And afterward, Moses and Aaron came and said to Pharaoh, "Thus says the Lord, the God of Israel, let my people go, that they may celebrate a feast to me in the wilderness." But Pharaoh said, "Who is the Lord that I should obey his voice to let Israel go? I do not know the Lord, and besides, I will not let Israel go." Now Moses and Aaron came to Pharaoh. That means came to Pharaoh's court. This is a big deal for some Hebrew slaves to come to court. But remember, Moses was thoroughly trained in Egyptian court customs, and these court customs and his training now stood him in good stead. So I'm sure he talked to the proper officials and he gained an audience with the Pharaoh. God uses everything in our past, everything, to work out good things later on in life. We don't know who the Pharaoh was, as I've said over and over again. The NIV Study Bible thinks it's probably Amenhotep II, but I don't know. We don't know for sure. And then Aaron, of course, Aaron's the one talking. He's the one doing the talking. "Thus says the Lord," that's Yahweh. So Aaron mentioned the name Yahweh. Now that sort of throws cold water on the claim of Jews that the name of God was ineffable. You can't pronounce it. Aaron pronounced it. I'd like to ask a rabbi that. How do you explain that? I'm sure they've got an answer for it. Maybe it only became ineffable later on, but not now. Now Aaron calls Yahweh the God of Israel. This is the first time that God has his name connected with the nation of Israel in Scripture, as Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown point out. Aaron says, "Let my people go, that they may celebrate a feast to me in the wilderness." That's what he says to Pharaoh. Now, this feast in the wilderness, is that the whole truth? John Gill says Moses and Aaron never intended to bring the Israelites back to Egypt, and so they asked for this lesser request in order to make Pharaoh look bad. I mean, it would be one thing for Pharaoh to say, "No, I'm not going to let you leave. Are you crazy? You are providing a bunch of cheap labor for me, and this is absurd to let us go, to let the Hebrew slaves go, and thus make alliance with our foreign enemies and come crashing over our borders. Are you crazy?" No, they asked for something smaller. They knew, according to John Gill, they knew that the Pharaoh would refuse any request they made, and so they made a small request to make him look a little more mean and petty than if they'd asked a big request such as, "Let us be free from slavery and go back to Canaan." Now, were they unreasonable, the Hebrews, Aaron and Moses, were they unreasonable to ask for a trip to the wilderness to worship their God? Not really. The Egyptians had treated them terribly, made them slaves, so why shouldn't they go? Why shouldn't they ask for some time off so they could worship their God? Now, where in the wilderness would they go? They would probably go to Mount Horeb or Mount Sinai, also known as Mount Sinai, in the wilderness of Midian. That's probably where they were planning to go to celebrate this feast. And then they would probably just keep on going to the Promised Land. Now, Pharaoh responds negatively, "Why should I let Israel go? I do not know the Lord." Now, what he's referring to here is he's thinking of Yahweh as a tutelary deity of the Israelites, a local god. Every tribe had their own gods, and those gods were only effective within the jurisdiction of the tribe that the god was the god over. And so Pharaoh's saying, "Look, Yahweh is your God. He's not my God. I've got no obligation to worship him. I'm not an Israelite. And besides, your God, what kind of a God have you got? He's your God. Look at you. You're a bunch of miserable, pathetic slaves. Why would I want to care about what your God says, that he wants you to go worship him? Whoop-de-doo, whoop-de-doo, whoop-de-doo." And this, of course, this attitude, this hardening of the heart of Pharaoh, this was the point of the 10 plagues. His heart was very, very hard. There had to be 10 plagues to sort of open up his mind to see that Yahweh was not just a local deity of the Israelites. He was the God of the whole universe. And so Pharaoh would come to know, not personally and intimately as a friend, but he would come to know the Lord as an enemy, and that he was no little god to deal with. Exodus 5:3 says this, "Then they said," that's Aaron and Moses, "the God of Hebrews has met with us. Please let us go a 3 days journey into the wilderness that we may sacrifice to the Lord our God. Otherwise, he will fall upon us with pestilence or with the sword." Now, 3 days journey to get into the wilderness to sacrifice, 3 days, as the NIV Study Bible says, is probably a conventional expression for short. It's just a short journey. Let us go. The implication is we'll be back. He never said they would come back. I guess he wasn't going to directly lie to the Pharaoh, but the implication is we just want to go 3 days and we'll come back. Some people say that no, the 3 days is the literal distance from Goshen to Mount Sinai. Now, upon the request to worship God in the wilderness, Pharaoh might well have said, "Well, why don't you just sacrifice in Goshen? Who's stopping you?" Well, the answer to that can be found in Exodus 8, 26 and 27. But Moses said, "It is not right to do so, to sacrifice in the wilderness, for we will sacrifice to the Lord our God what is an abomination to the Egyptians. If we sacrifice what is an abomination to the Egyptians before their eyes, will they not then stone us? We must go a 3 days journey into the wilderness and sacrifice to the Lord our God as he commands us." The idea is, since the Egyptians worshipped every living animal that existed about, and especially Apis the bull. I know you know, if you know about Egyptian mythology, that was the big one. Apis, I think it was Cambyses, the Persian emperor, when the Persians captured Egypt in the 6th century B.C., Cambyses was stupid enough to go kill their sacred bull, and it sort of poisoned the atmosphere after that, and he had a hard time governing the Egyptians. Well, imagine if the Jews are sacrificing bulls, which is part of their sacrificial ritual, as we see later, is later codified in the Pentateuch, in the Torah, in the Pentateuch, in the law. They're going to be sacrificing bulls, and the Egyptians are going to say, "What are you doing killing our sacred animals?" And they go come stone them. So this is a logical request for Moses to say, "Let us go into the wilderness where we'll be apart from the Egyptians so they won't stone us. We need a sacrifice." Let's read also Genesis 46 and 34. "Your servants have been keepers of livestock from our youth even until now, both we and our fathers, that you may live in the land of Goshen, for every shepherd is loathsome to the Egyptians." So the Egyptians hated shepherds too, and guess what? The Hebrew slaves were, that's what they were. They were shepherds. So they were loathsome shepherds doing abominable sacrifices. It made sense for Moses to say, "We need to get away so we can practice our religion." Now, Jameson Fawcett Brown says concerning this attempted sacrifice, "In saying this, they," Aaron and Moses, "concealed their ultimate design of abandoning the kingdom, and by making this partial request at first, they probably wished to try the king's temper before they disclosed their intention any further." Well, that's another reason why they didn't tell Pharaoh the truth. And of course, there's an ethical question here. Did not Aaron and Moses deceive the king? Weren't they lying to the king by not telling him the whole truth? Is a half-truth just the same thing as a full lie? Well, no. This is war, basically. You know, you're trying to get the people out of slavery. You don't go up there and say, "Hey, king, we want to leave your country." That's going to be immediately shut down. That's stupid. That's the council of perfection, which is always the council of stupidity. I actually think the Pharaoh knew they were ultimately planning to leave, and that's why he didn't want to let them go. I mean, he later on says, "Well, you're lazy. You need to be working 3 days off. Well, I guess 3 days to get there, 3 days to get back, 6 days off from work." That's not going to kill Pharaoh. Probably it would rest the slaves up. They'd probably work better when they got back. I suspect that Pharaoh didn't want them to go because he knew that they were going to keep right on going and leave. Now, Aaron and Moses say, "Look, Pharaoh, if we don't sacrifice, Yahweh will fall upon us with pestilence and with a sword." Now, is that true? Is God going to wipe them out with disease or military conquest because they don't sacrifice? I don't think so. John Gill says that the reason that Moses and Aaron said this is that it was an indirect appeal to Pharaoh's self-interest. If the Hebrews got wiped out because they didn't sacrifice, well, there goes all that cheap slave labor. Now, remember now, Hebrew slavery was different than slavery in the American South. The Hebrew masters did not provide food, shelter, medical care, and adjudication of disputes to the slaves as the American slave owners had to do. The Egyptians just said, "No, you Hebrews, you take care of your food, shelter, medical care, and you adjudicate your own disputes, and you go out and gather straw and make bricks." So if the Hebrews left, the Pharaoh would be facing a great financial loss. And so Moses is saying, man, we could die from pestilence if we don't sacrifice to Yahweh. And look, Pharaoh, if God is angry at us for not sacrificing, a fortiori, he's going to be angry at you Egyptians for not letting us go. I think that's pretty reasonable, John Gill's argument. Adam Clark disagrees. He says, quote, they, the Hebrews, represent to him, the Pharaoh, the danger they should be in by disobeying their God, but do not do so much as hint at any punishment that would follow to Pharaoh. Well, maybe they don't state it explicitly, but I think the implied threat is there. We're going to get wiped out. So we need to go sacrifice so you don't lose a bunch of slave labor. I think Moses and Aaron are working all the angles here. We go now to Exodus 5, verses 4 and 5. But the king of Egypt said to them, Moses and Aaron, why do you draw the people away from their work? Get back to your labors. Again, Pharaoh said, look, the people of the land are now many, and you would have them cease from their labors. Labors, labors. Pharaoh was more interested in money than justice. And he was more interested in short-term profits more than long-term profits, because after all, you work your slave population to death. You don't give them some time off or vacation every once in a while. You're going to wear them out, and they're not going to produce much. Slave labor already is inefficient because there's no incentive for the worker to innovate and to do better. And then you don't give them any rest. You don't give them any religious expression. Stupid from a management point of view, Pharaoh's point of view. But he wanted that short-term money, that profit, that labor. I want some bricks. I'm going to build a pyramid or something. Build my tomb so I can meet some people in the afterlife. Now, Pharaoh said, look, the people are many. Why did he mention the many people down there? Well, here's some possible implications of that. He might be saying, hey, I'm going to lose a lot of labor. And that's, we can see that because he said, you made them cease from their labors. There are many people down there that are going to cease from their labor. So the idea is, I'm going to lose a lot of labor if I can grant your request, Moses in there, and so forget it. Also, there are many people down there. He could be referring to the fact that there's a greater chance of a slave revolt. The more slaves you got, the more chance there's a slave revolt, especially when they're being treated horribly. Gil, Clark, and Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown, all three suggest that. Now, because there are many Hebrews now in the land of Goshen, this shows that the edict which forced the killing of Hebrew male children had obviously failed in its effect, as Adam Clark points out. He says that that law had probably been repealed. Remember, the Hebrew midwives would enforce it anyway. Genocide is difficult. I mean, even Hitler had trouble exterminating all those Jews. It was a big logistical problem to kill people. It's just amazing. We get caught up in the horror of it. You watch enough films about World War II and documentaries, and you read the documentation that went along with the extermination of the Jews in the gas chambers, and it's just amazing. This is a hard thing to do, and they weren't able to ultimately cover it up. They tried to cover it up, but they didn't do it. Now the whole world knows about it, except for a few moronic Holocaust deniers. Now, all these 600,000 or so male slaves, plus women and children, were there when Moses was born, was 80 years before. Moses was born, spent 40 years growing up in Egypt, then he spent 40 years in Midian. So there's been plenty of time for a lot of multiplication to be going on. We go now to Exodus 5, verses 6 through 9. So the same day Pharaoh commanded the taskmasters over the people and their foremen, saying, you are no longer to give the people straw to make brick as previously. Let them go and gather straw for themselves. But the quota of bricks which they were making previously you shall impose on them. You are not to reduce any of it, because they are lazy. Therefore they cry out, let us go and sacrifice to our God. Let the labor be heavier on the men, and let them work at it, so that they will pay no attention to false words. Now, this response from Pharaoh is very negative, but God had already told Moses that Pharaoh wasn't going to listen to Moses. We see that in Exodus 4:21. The Lord instructed Moses, when you go back to Egypt, make sure you do before Pharaoh all the wonders that I have put within your power, but I will harden his heart so that he won't let the people go. So Moses knew, or he should have known, that the Pharaoh wasn't going to listen to him, but he had to make the request to show Pharaoh's hard heart and to show the justice of God in dealing mightily against Pharaoh and to judicially condemn Pharaoh for his hard heart and his sin. Now, God had told Moses that in Exodus 4 that Pharaoh would not listen. Pharaoh not only didn't listen, he did something worse. He commanded the slave situation to get worse for the Hebrews. No straw. And of course, that put Moses and Aaron in a bad light in front of their Hebrew followers. So the taskmasters commanded the foremen, those are Hebrews who are over their own slaves, and they said, gather straw, which would be stubble from the wheat fields. Now here's some options as to the use of the straw in the making of bricks. The NIV Study Bible says that the straw was chopped and mixed with the clay to bind the clay to make bricks stronger. I think that's probably the answer. Option number two is from John Gill. The straw was used to burn in the furnaces to cure the bricks. Adam Clark disagrees with that and says that Egyptian bricks were never burnt. I don't know how Egyptian bricks were made. I don't think that's a good speculation. Option number three, the straw was used to cover the bricks from the heat of the sun to keep them from cracking. Well, that's very interesting. Maybe it was used for all three. Yeah, who knows? It could be all three uses. But the main use was to chop it up and mix it with clay to make the clay bind to make the bricks strong. Now, these bricks were made by the government. This was a government monopoly. They were not sold on the open market. And, of course, you wonder what they were used for to build a... They weren't used to build a pyramid because those were huge stones. And they came from the southern end of the Nile River, I think, if I remember correctly. Floated on the river. Wasn't from the Hebrews. They made bricks. Now, the Pharaoh accused the Hebrews of being lazy and wanted some time off. They weren't really going there to worship their God. They were lazy. Because they are lazy, they cry out, let us go and sacrifice to our Lord. Now, this is a typical cry of non-believing people, a typical complaint by non-believing people about believers. You're just so lazy. You don't want to work on Sunday. All that time you waste worshiping your God, you could be out there being a productive member of society. We go now to Exodus 5, verses 10 through 14. So the taskmasters of the people and their foremen, the taskmasters of the Egyptian administrators, shall we say, the foremen of the Hebrew foremen, the taskmasters of the people and their foremen went out and spoke to the people, saying, thus says Pharaoh, I am not going to give you any straw. You go and get straw for yourselves wherever you can find it, but none of your labor will be reduced. So the people scattered through all the land of Egypt to gather stubble for straw. The taskmasters pressed them, saying, complete your work quota, your daily amount, just as when you had straw. Moreover, the foremen of the sons of Israel, whom Pharaoh's taskmasters had set over them, were beaten and were asked, why have you not completed your required amount either yesterday or today in making brick as previously? The foremen were beaten, not the slaves. In general, it just goes to show that leaders are the ones that take the heat a lot of times worse than their followers. So the people scattered through all the land of Egypt. That means all the land of Goshen, really, that part of Egypt where they were living, trying to find straw. Now, private landowners would not hinder the Hebrew slaves from gathering that straw. For one reason, almost all the land of Egypt was owned by the state. If things continued as they were a couple of hundred years before during the famines, when Joseph bought up all the land of the state in order to sell the grain that kept the Egyptians alive back then, Genesis 47:20 says this, so Joseph bought all the land of Egypt for Pharaoh, for every Egyptian sold his field because the famine was severe upon them. Well, that assumes that same things are the same 200 years later. They might not be. Could be the government started selling some of that land back. Who knows? But even if it was in the hands of private landowners, stubble's of no use to them. I would imagine, why would they care if slaves are going out cleaning up the field unless they wanted to grind it back under the soil for fertilization purposes? I don't know. I'm not a farmer. But at any rate, It's not a problem for the Hebrew slaves to go out and get the stubble. It's a lot of work, but nobody's going to stop them. And notice that when they didn't meet their quota on the first day, the foremen were beaten. Well, you know, that's a great management technique, isn't it? You want to increase production, so you beat your slaves. That reminds me of some signs I've seen in some businesses. I forgot how it goes, but they're sort of cynical and talking about the beatings shall, after the break, the beating shall recommence or something like that. That's not the way you get people to work, folks, is beating them. You reward them for good performance. You don't beat them for bad performance. You encourage them when they screw up. And you realize that they're not slaves. They are people who want to produce at their work, and they want to, because they're made in the image of God and God created, they want to create things at their job. They want to do well. And so you encourage them to do what they naturally want to do. Most workers, not all, I don't realize there's some deadbeats that are just a disgrace to the human race, I know that, but most workers are not like that. Beating slaves is a stupid way to get better production. Well, the taskmasters went to the foreman and said, today you haven't made the complaint, haven't made the quota. The first day the taskmasters made no complaint, I guess that's to give them a chance to see if they could do it. Well, the second day, they not only complained about the Hebrews not meeting the quota, they beat the Hebrews. We go now to Exodus chapter 5, verses 15 through 21. Then the foreman of the sons of Israel came and cried out to Pharaoh, saying, why do you deal this way with your servants? Remember now, the foreman of the Hebrews, Hebrew foreman of the slaves, why do you deal this way with your servants? They said to Pharaoh, there is no straw given to your servants. Yet they keep saying to us, make bricks, though they is the taskmasters. And behold, your servants are being beaten, but it is the fault of your own people. But he, Pharaoh, said, you are lazy, very lazy. Therefore you say, let us go and sacrifice to the Lord. So go now and work, for you will be given no straw, yet you must deliver the quota of bricks. The foreman of the sons of Israel saw that they were in trouble because they were told you must not reduce your daily amount of bricks. When they left Pharaoh's presence, they met Moses and Aaron as they were waiting for them. They said to them, may the Lord look upon you and judge you, for you have made us odious in Pharaoh's sight and in the sight of his servants. Pharaoh's servants are the taskmasters, to put a sword in their hand to kill us. Now, that's a little bit exaggerated. Pharaoh didn't say he was going to kill his slaves. That would be stupid. He'd lose all that free slave labor. But that's what the foreman felt like. He says, Pharaoh doesn't care about us. He just as soon like to kill us. Now, here we see foreman complaining to Pharaoh. They didn't have any idea that Pharaoh was behind the offensive order that the foreman were complaining about, as John Gill points out. We read in Exodus 5, verse 6, which we just covered. So the same day, Pharaoh commanded the taskmasters over the people and their foreman, saying, well, we have to assume here that Pharaoh gave that order outside of the hearing of the Hebrew foreman, and then the order was relayed from the taskmasters, the Egyptian taskmasters, to the Hebrew foreman. And so they didn't realize what was going on, so they go to Pharaoh and complain. And they say, my goodness, not only we don't have any straw, we don't meet the quotas, now they're beating us. Now in the East, when one was beaten, he was beaten by bastinado. Here's how that worked. The victim lay on his stomach, and then he bent his knees, exposing his feet as his legs are up in the air. He exposes his feet, and then the feet were beaten. And you say, well, that doesn't sound so bad. Well, actually, it was extremely painful. The victim often couldn't walk for weeks, and sometimes he was lame for life. You just don't know how sensitive the bottom of the feet are. I had plantar fasciitis for a long time when I was in China, and I'd go to get masseuses once a week, and I'd get them to work over my feet, and they would start using their massage techniques on the bottom of my feet, and I thought I was going to die and go to heaven prematurely. It hurt so bad. I let them do it because I wanted to work that plantar fasciitis out. But it's amazing how sensitive the bottom of the feet are. And that's how they were beaten, probably. At least that's how they typically did it in the East, according to John Gill and Adam Clark. Now, again, the Pharaoh said they were lazy. He loved to say, hey, you guys, you slaves are lazy. You lazy, good-for-nothing slaves. I just mentioned earlier that that's what irreligious people do when they complain about religious people taking time off from work to worship God. Here's something they never contemplate. Did they ever consider that prayer will make work go much more efficiently? Well, of course not. They don't believe. And the steel industry used to work in America in the first part of the 20th century. The steel workers would work 7 days a week. When they finally started working them 6 days a week, they discovered that accidents went down and production went up, even though the workers were not working at all on Sunday. Well, that's not surprising. People get worn out. They don't work well. Now the foreman come out, Aaron and Moses are waiting outside, and here come the foreman, and they say, man, Moses and Aaron, you have made us odious in Pharaoh's sight. Leaders are often the first one blamed when something goes wrong, even when it's not their fault. This was not Moses and Aaron's fault, but who's going to take the heat? So that was pretty bad for Moses and Aaron. But Clark says we should be indulgent with the Hebrew foreman concerning these unkind words spoken to Moses and Aaron because the situation was really, really bad. They were upset, and I guess that's true. I can understand why they might complain. We go now to Exodus 5, verses 22 and 23, and we will finish up this chapter. Then Moses returned to the Lord and said, O Lord, why have you brought harm to this people? Why did you ever send me? Ever since I came to Pharaoh to speak in your name, he has done harm to this people, and you have not delivered your people at all. Moses returned to the Lord. You notice he didn't have an answer to give to the Hebrew foreman. You've made us odious. How can you claim to be a leader? Going to lead us out. Lead us. You're going to be the great deliverer. And look what's happened. You've made the situation worse. The foreman's charges were pretty accurate. They were exactly accurate. And so it wasn't really Moses could say to the foreman. So instead, he goes to God. He returned to the Lord. Now, Gill and Clark speculate this is a particular place where Moses always prayed. I don't know why they say that. Who knows where he went, where they went to pray. And then the first thing that Moses said is, why did you do this? Why have you brought harm to this people? Why did you ever send me? And this sounds like Moses is blaming God. But actually, Moses is quite accurate. God is sovereign. He could have stopped the increased affliction if he so desired, but he didn't do it. But his ultimate purpose was to get the Israelites out of Egypt. And now the Israelites were much more willing to take the big step because of the persecution and the slavery. Also, the Israelites are more odious in the eyes of the Egyptians. And so the Egyptians are at the beginning of a process that the Hebrews will become more and more odious until finally the Egyptians say, get out of here. We don't want you here anymore. That would be, of course, after the 10 plagues. This reminds me, I've prayed so many times, God, deliver America from the anti-Christian, the petty little anti-Christian secular humanist, the progressive left that hates the church and hates your morality, don't know the difference between a boy and a girl. And as I sit here now and speak, we are in the week in which the head of that peculiar, that petty little antichrist political party is about to take the presidency of the United States. And the persecution of the church is just about to get worse and worse and worse. And I think, why, God? Well, there's a reason. Now, Moses says in verse 23, ever since I came to Pharaoh to speak in your name, I'm speaking in your name, God, and you would think that your name would be strong enough to deliver the Hebrew slaves. I didn't come speaking in my name. I spoke in your name, or Aaron spoke in your name, and look what happened. So Moses is hinting that the powerful name of God should have been enough to get success, but it wasn't. So Moses has a questioning attitude here. He can't figure out, why did God let this happen? Now, Moses says that the people were not delivered. Obviously, they weren't. But this shows something to us. Oppression is not necessarily a sign of disfavor toward a people. You can look at people who are degraded and say, well, they brought it on themselves because of their sin. You know, there's a lot of drug addicts you can say that to, or prostitutes, whatever, sure. But the Hebrew slaves weren't drug addicts or prostitutes. They were being treated terribly, and they were poor. But that didn't mean that God was looking disfavorably upon them. And the converse of that is true. We can't say that affluence and prosperity is a sign of divine favor. I mean, some of the most pagan countries on earth are prosperous. Look at Japan. There's hardly any Christians there, and for years, not recently, well, they're a prosperous country, basically. Look at America. We are the most ungodly country on earth probably now. America's fairly, very prosperous. I could go on. You can't judge people by how much money they have. You can't say this is what their worth is. Isn't that interesting how we say what's your net worth, as if our value is to be determined by how big our bank account is? Look at Joseph. He came to Egypt. He was a slave. He was favored by God, though. He was a slave. And of course, later on, God elevated him and made him number two in Egypt. And God can take a lot of poor people and make them prosperous later. So, and then they would be rich and prosperous at the same time. Rich and favored by God at the same time as Abraham and Isaac were. When they died, they were rich and God loved them. So we can't say one way or the other. You can't say that affluence is a sign of godliness. You can't say that affluence is a sign of ungodliness. You can't say that poverty is a sign of godliness. You can't say that poverty is a sign of ungodliness. Well, with that little sermonette, we will now finish Exodus 5 to prepare us for our next audio, which is Exodus 6, verses 1 through 30. God is going to promise Moses that the Hebrew slaves will be delivered, and then we're going to look at the genealogy of Moses and Aaron. I hope you stay tuned for that audio, and I hope you enjoyed this one.